It is time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage for Robinhood Radio and exclusive to Robinhood Radio. David is a multimedia and international journalist with his own online column at themediabeat.us. And as a special correspondent since 2012, he has contributed TV reports to the PBS network, mostly on ethical issues. Here's David.
This is David Tereshchuk, reporting in not from my usual perch in the media capital of the world, New York City, but instead from out on the road, overseas. I'm in fact in London, England, to bring you the Media Beat for the weekend beginning October 27th, 2023. The media landscape in the UK looks pretty much like that of the US this week. It's dominated by coverage of the Middle East war. There's the dramatic matter of hostages, just a few so far, being released by Hamas. That prompted a big headline from London's Daily Express newspaper. Peace gesture by freed hostage in the face of evil. The paper was referring, naturally, to 85-year-old Yocheved Lifshitz, who shook hands with her mask-wearing captor, saying farewell with the Hebrew word shalom for peace. There are reports on the mere trickle of aid trucks into Gaza via the Rafah entry point from Egypt, and the enclave's drying up of vital fuel reserves for essential services under the pressure of Israel's blockade, tighter and fiercer than it's ever been. And there are headlines from back in my hometown of New York, where at the United Nations building, Israel vented fury at the UN's top official, Secretary General Antonio Guterres. He had dared to say that Israel's bombardment of Gaza, in preparation, it seems, for a full-scale ground attack, constituted, quote, clear violations of humanitarian law. Guterres was evidently attempting even-handedness, as he said, and the quote wasn't given in its entirety in all UK media. He said, "The grievances of the Palestinian people cannot justify the appalling attacks by Hamas, and those appalling attacks cannot justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people." The Israelis, by contrast, of course, see the appalling Hamas attacks as being entirely of a different order, not to be compared with their own actions. Those were a step too far in terrorist aggression and without parallel, they say, in all the decades of Arab-Israeli conflict. The war zone saw a visit from this country's Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, whose very name speaks of Britain's one-time imperial rule over vast expanses of the world, including the India of the Sunak family's ancestry. The Prime Minister had to report to Parliament as the second overseas head of government to make such a Mideast visit after America's President Joe Biden did, and he was quickly followed by President Macron of France. And most of the UK press echoed the Prime Minister's portrayal in Parliament of Britain as a globally important force in this current international crisis. The UK's voice matters. That was the Prime Minister's own way of putting it early in his House of Commons statement. Such evident need to constantly remind the world, remind also the British people themselves, it seems, of this country's supposedly significant standing, will probably come as no surprise to American ears. American diplomats are generally polite about the UK, but the memory is still strong of one among their member being very blunt one time long ago about such matters of who is important internationally. In the 1960s, Secretary of State Dean Acheson was judged to be cruel but truthful, when he said, "Great Britain has," and note that he was still gentlemanly enough to use the word great, "Britain has lost an empire, but not yet found a role." Apart from some enthusiasts in the British press, it would be hard to find many people claiming that Britain has yet found a role, even now. It's pretty obvious from my voice that I was brought up here in Britain, but after 30-plus years of domicile in the US, and gaining citizenship as an American, it always takes me a little aback when I drop into the old country and observe at first hand the rather insular, sometimes even jingoistic approach to international affairs that's pervasive in much of the UK media. Great play in the press has been made of Prime Minister Sunak's message to Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu. He insisted, Sunak said, that any harm to innocent civilians in Gaza should be minimized while Israel exerts its right to self-defense. This, of course, is a dutiful repetition of Joe Biden's message last week. Sunak also announced an additional 20 million UK pounds, that's about 25 million in US dollars, of humanitarian aid to civilians in Gaza. That's, quote, more than doubling our previous support to the Palestinian people, if I'm to quote Sunak again. Some British commentators went overboard about this, somewhat forgetting the wider context. Just across Britain's proverbial doorstep in continental Europe, the European Union will be sending three times that amount of aid to Gaza. And incidentally, the US has promised far in excess of either UK or Europe, $100 million, in fact. I have to report from here that Europe, comparisons with Europe, little swipes at Europe, still bedevil many subjects of public discourse. We need to remember that a full decade or more after Dean Acheson's caustic assessment about not finding a role, Britain in the 1970s hit upon one way of finding a role. It joined the European Union. And now, 50 years later, Sunak's ruling party in government, the Conservatives, have taken Britain out of Europe again with the upheaval of Brexit. At the time, of course, under the less and less remembered leader, Boris Johnson. Much of the British press will not let go of that argument over leaving and how terrible the EU is. And even the current Middle East bloodshed is another occasion for it. The conservative, I could say very conservative, Daily Telegraph made a top front page headline out of Europe's current position, vigorously promoting a humanitarian pause in the fighting. The headline said, EU clash with UK and US on ceasefire. This picture being conjured up of it being Europe who is out of step with the rest of us suggests that little has changed in the mindset of many UK media. I'm put in mind of the Daily Mail, another nationalistic conservative paper, when it infamously published this weather-related headline, Fog in English Channel, Continent Isolated. I do, though, want to be fair about Britain's sense of itself. There is one laudable effort being launched here next month, well away from the particular conflicts that dominate the news, war in the Middle East and in Ukraine. It's an event to be hosted by the British government and intended to be thoroughly international in its makeup and tackling vitally important international matters. It's the world's first summit on artificial intelligence safety. The summit will be held at Bletchley Park, a country venue that was chosen with some appropriateness. Indeed, it invokes elements of British history that are actually positive. You'll doubtless recall Bletchley Park as a birthplace of modern computer science and, famously, as the intelligence centre where Nazi wartime codes were broken in a major contribution to the Allies winning World War II. In preparation for the summit, the leading think tank, Chatham House, here in London, held a meeting of minds this week that I was glad to attend. The organisation is more formally titled the Royal Institute of International Affairs, but despite that very English, monarchical name, it is genuinely global in its outlook, and it's far more commonly and familiarly known as just Chatham House, the building where its work goes on. It's also home to what's known as Chatham House rules, rules that determine how its discussions are reported in the media. They're designed to protect participants, who are often high-ranking government members from countries around the world. The rules permit such officials to talk more frankly and openly. Under those rules, the press may report what's being said in a session, but not by exactly whom it is being said. In my experience, it has indeed helped to encourage free-flowing exchanges of often contentious views and positions. However, for this particular seminar, entitled Dealing with the AI Global Risk, Chatham House rules were lifted. I can therefore cite anyone I like, name, rank and number if need be. While the session set out to address the dangers and threats posed by AI, It displayed a tendency common enough among gatherings of computer specialists to simply take as read the extraordinary creative usefulness that is on offer from the AI phenomenon. When asked for some specifics of the benefits AI is bringing us, one of the panelists, Francine Bennett of the Ada Lovelace Institute, told all of us present that she has a heart pacemaker installed. And unsurprisingly, she is hugely grateful for the machine learning that helped make her instrument as powerful and as subtle in its operation as it evidently is, keeping her alive every day. Her institute, by the way, may not be widely known among lay audiences. It was named in honor of Ada Lovelace, who was a 19th century trailblazer for women in math and science, and also, incidentally, the daughter of the romantic poet Lord Byron. It's worth recording that our AI and its dangers event was greatly representative of women. Counting the chairperson, Olivia O'Sullivan, from Chatham House itself, the discussion panel comprised six people, five of whom were female. The sole male was Professor Joshua Bengio of the University of Montreal and a winner of the Turing Award, the computer world's equivalent to a Nobel Prize. The overwhelming message of the night, voiced clearly by Jean Innes of the Alan Turing Institute, but taken up repeatedly by others, was the sheer urgency of the task to devise internationally accepted modes of regulation to safeguard the public against the worst excesses of AI's high-powered generative mechanism. It's urgent because of what almost everyone also emphasized, the frantic, until now barely credible, pace of advances in the field. Zoe Kleinman, the BBC's technological editor, said pointedly, "What is so striking is the speed of change, and the problem is that no one in government can keep up with the rapid pace." And what kind of government, or any form of governance, could possibly take on the role of regulating the industry's hectic growth and its conduct? As Katie O'Donovan, Google's director of public policy, pointed out, AI knows no borders. Maybe, it was suggested, it could be a job for the UN, rather on analogy with the UN already doing its best to uphold the Universal Declaration of Human Rights since 1948. Given how well that set of global rules has been policed over the years, maybe it's not such a good precedent. As the AI session came to its close at Chatham House, my dear companion said, "The trouble is, the horse is out of the barn and well down the road now. It's hard not to think we're already too late." Let's hope the International Summit, just 5 days from now, will fare better as it brings together interested and powerful parties from around the globe, and that they might conceivably agree on a shared approach. High-level participants there will be roughly divided into the US as the leading innovator in the field, the EU as the most eager regulator in the world, and China as a practitioner who plays entirely by its own rules. Let's wish them all luck in agreeing on something. That's all from the Media Beat this week. If you have been, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.